Marriage by Susan Ferrier, dramatised in 3 episodes by Patricia Hannah. Episode 2, South.
Gartmarley Cottage, Argyllshire, October the 13th, 1813. My dear Lady Juliana, the locket you sent Mary for her 18th birthday arrived safely. I wish you might have seen how she kissed it and wept over the lock of her mother's hair within. I know her thoughts are ever of you and her dear father, our poor Henry in his lonely grave, far from us in India. From the moment you entrusted Mary to my care, it was my chief aim to engraft into her soul the purest principles of religion. And from the Bible alone, she has been taught the duties of morality.
But Mrs. Douglas has no understanding of the difficulties of female education. Young people never can have enough said to them.
I'm sure, Jackie, that's very true.
L'inutilité de la vie des femmes est la première source de le désordre. There is great truth in this observation. And a portion of Mary's time has been devoted to the daily practice of administering to the wants and misfortunes of her fellow creatures.
Mary has been allowed to waste her time and squander her money among idle vagrants.
Economy of time and money, I confess, I have ever been accustomed to consider as virtues.
But life's embellishments have not been neglected. Mary dances in a free and graceful manner. Her singing style is full of simplicity and feeling, and her drawings display a perfect knowledge of perspective and the study of the bust.
I have never discovered when or how Mary got her lessons. She has contrived to pick things up wonderfully.
She is naturally endowed by nature. I have merely managed judiciously the improvement of the talents committed to her care. I have strived to make Mary virtuous and left the rest to him who alone knoweth what is good for us.
Mary's back isn't worth a farthing, since Mrs. Douglas would not give it the benefit of the Glenfern back brace.
We have always been quite famous for our backs.
Oh, to be sure. Lady McLaughlin says people are always glad to see them.
Alas, the past few months have proved unhappy ones for Mary. In the midst of the celebrations for the christening of my long-awaited son, the Laird, our dear good father-in-law, passed peacefully, if unexpectedly, away. The impression on Mary was a powerful one. The image of her grandfather dying, dead, his grim features, his ghastly visage, his convulsive grasp, seem ever present with her. Her nervous system has received a shock too powerful for all the strength of her understanding to contend with.
I declare, I'm certain Mary has always read a great deal too much for her own good. Oh, reading's a very dangerous thing.
Much depends on the choice of books. For Dyce's sermons on the history of Scotland are two of the very few books I would put into the hands of a young woman.
Mary's constitution is naturally delicate.
Only she'd had Lady McLaughlin's nice warm lozenges as a child.
And the shock of her grandfather's death with its consequent melancholy has had a deleterious effect on her health.
It is nonsense to ascribe Mary's dwining to her grandfather's death. None of our healths have suffered.
And then there's the Girdleys here, his own daughters, who of course must have felt a great deal more than anybody else.
We felt a great deal more than anybody else.
But yet you see how they have got up their spirits. I'm sure it's wonderful.
Girls that sup their porridge will always cut a good figure.
Dr. Edmonston has recommended Mary be removed to the south of England for the winter, where the milder air and change of scene will prove efficacious. How so desirable event is to be accomplished is the difficulty. By the death of his father, a variety of business has devolved on my husband, Mr. Douglas, which obliges him to fix his residence at Glenfern. It is impossible for me to leave our infant son, and taking him on so long a journey is equally out of the question. The only resource is to send Mary to Beech Park for a few months to stay with you, Lady Juliana, and your brother, Lord Courtland.
The woman is a hypocrite. I gave her my child because she had none of her own, and now she has one, she has no use for mine.
Mary has been too long an alien from her own family. Under her uncle's roof, so close to Bath and its cultural amenities, new scenes will give a stimulus to her mind, and in the society of her mother and sister, she cannot be unhappy. My sadness at parting from Mary is assuaged only by the thought of the joy this reunion will bring to her, her sister, and yourself. I am your most affectionate sister-in-law, Alice Douglas.
Oh, what can I do with a girl who has been educated in Scotland? She must be vulgar. All Scotch women are so. They have red hands and rough voices. They yawn and blow their noses and talk and laugh loud and do a thousand shocking things.
If that is the case, dear sister, I shall send my least fastidious servants with the carriage to meet her in Edinburgh.
Can be turned into anything. Oh, I hope you will never look at an Englishman, Mary. You're a very dissipated, unprincipled set.
Don't be afraid, dear Aunt Lizzie. I shall come back to you. You're all Highland Mary.
Highland Mary!
Yes, Highland Mary!
Are we ready?
Be back and praise.
I trust, Mary, you have the whole duty of man laid down in a plain and familiar way to hand.
Yes, Aunt Jackie. I shall read from it every day.
Woodhull pie, potted notes, head, pops and snaps, all in the covered basket. Do you hear that, Archie? Under the carriage seat.
Aye, Aunt Nicky, we have them safe.
I shall think of you every mouthful, dear aunt.
We must start now. It's a long way to Edinburgh.
Even longer.
I know you will make a place for yourself in the hearts of your mother and sister, dearest Mary, as you have in ours.
Oh, my dear aunt, how can I leave you?
Dear child, heaven sent you to me, and heaven will restore you to me in a few short months.
Goodbye, Alice. Look after the boy. I shall miss you both.
Goodbye, Archibald. God will keep us safe till you return.
Archie!
Goodbye!
Goodbye, Mary! Don't do much time, the horse is Archie!
Dear
aunt!
Dear uncle, it is so very kind of you to undertake this long and dreary journey on my account.
Oh, no, Mary, it's the least I can do. Aye.
Summer has long fled from our mountains, but you will have returned to Glenfarn before the snows. Oh, how their lofty grandeur elevates the soul. Oh, listen to the awful stillness of nature in her solitude.
Aye. I'll close the window. One of Aunt Nicky's pastries and a spot of wine should cheer us up.
Oh, look! Over there! Oh, look, it's Rob Roy's cave! Oh, poor man! Driven from his home and family by brutal soldiers.
Aye, all the lairds hereabouts paid for it gladly. The man was a damned nuisance. Didn't Aunt Nicky say there was...
What a knight's head! Oh, here it is. Do you want a spoon?
Aye, and a spot of wine.
The lowlands! Wake up, Uncle! How soft the air seems. How gentle the hills.
Aye. Good farming and easy living. Now, I think it's time for a piece of moor fowl pie and a drop of wine.
Bannockburn! Oh! How one's heart thrills at that name. Bannockburn.
Is there any pie?
No.
Potted head?
No.
Pastries, bannocks, cheese?
No.
Oh, well, I'll just have a drop of wine.
It's finished, Uncle. Everything's finished. Wake up, Uncle! I can see Edinburgh, Edina, Scotia's darling seat. All hail thy palaces and towers. Oh, to think Mary Stuart once trod these very cobbles. Oh,
Right, Holyrood.
To think these very rooms were once gay with the laughter of that poor blighted queen. See, the blood of David Rizzio. For 300 years it has resisted all human efforts to efface it. Oh, I love to believe in things supernatural. It seems to connect us more with another world than when everything is seen to proceed in the mere ordinary course of nature. I cannot bear to imagine a dreary chasm betwixt the inhabitants of this world and beings of a higher sphere. I love to fancy...
Come along, Mary. You've been long enough here. Let us try whether a breeze on Calton Hill will not dispel these cobwebs from your brain.
Oh, what a view! It is exquisite! And you are in the right, my dear uncle. The ideas which are inspired by the contemplation of such a spectacle as this are far, oh, how far superior to those excited by mere works of art. There I can at best think but of the inferior agents of Providence. Here, the soul rises from nature up to nature's God.
Oh. Mary, you'll be taken for a Methodist if you talk in this manner. Aye. Look at the time. We must return to the inn. Lord Cortland's carriage will be waiting. Aye, aye, Mary.
Oh, uncle. Uncle, dearest uncle.
Now. Lord Cortland's driver assures me the roads are good and the horses fresh.
Uncle!
You will be safe at Beech Park before you can say...
Mother! Mother!
Oh! Dead! She's dead! Adelaide, Emily, help me.
Dead? I cannot look, it is too distressing. How sad, come all this way only to die.
Poor Cousin Mary.
My poor daughter. She's almost as pretty as Adelaide. Her lovely golden hair all tumbled. Her little hand lifeless in mine.
Lady Juliana, she breathes.
Her eyes are opening.
She's not dead.
She's alive.
She must have fainted when she saw you, Lady Juliana.
Only a faint.
Oh, good gracious, what a fuss. I faint quite regularly.
My mother!
No, don't call me mother. It's such a vulgar appellation. Oh, Emily, convey Mary to her apartment. Good night, my dear. I hope you will be in better spirits tomorrow. Will you play, Adelaide? I feel quite agitated.
Poor little bird. Oh, you should be home, in your own dear country, singing with your friends and family.
You're up and dressed. How well you look this morning, my dear cousin.
Good morning, dear Emily.
You look so like my dear Edward.
Edward?
Your brother. Of course, you've never seen him. He is at sea. He has been at sea these 2 years. But I fell in love with him when I was 6 years old and will have no other. Oh, you have got his smile too. You must let me see that very often.
I am sure I shall have cause. But at present I feel anxious about my mother and sister. The agitation of our meeting and all my weakness. Oh, I fear it has been too much for them.
Indeed, you need be under no uneasiness on their account. Their feelings are not so easily disturbed. You will see them both at breakfast. So come along.
Where do canaries come from? Do you know?
Lady Juliana has them sent from London. But before that, I cannot say. Do you want another one?
Oh, no.
Have a little patience, dear Mary. They will be here at their usual time. Nobody in this house is slave to ours or jeûner with each other's society. Liberty is the motto here.
Oh, what a selfish, cold-hearted thing is grandeur. Adelaide! Adelaide! My sister!
I hope you're better this morning. Pass me the morning post, Lady Emily.
Oh, Emily, how different the manners are here. I'm sure my sister loves me, Well, she does not shorten the same way I should have done.
Adelaide's manners are so fine, one could almost believe her to be without feeling.
How do you do, dear Adelaide? They are jealous. Sweet Orpheus, sweet Eurydice.
Mother!
Absurd, my dear. I am not forever clutching Lord Cortland and crying brother. You must really get the better of this foolish weakness. These scenes are too much for me. I was most excessively shocked last night, and you ought not to have quitted your room today. Where is Dr. Redgill?
He has got sent up a turtle at Admiral Yellowchop's.
So vastly provoking that he should be out of the way the only time I have wished to see him since he came to this house.
Who is this favoured individual whose absence you are so pathetically lamenting, Juliana?
Oh, that disagreeable Dr. Redgill. He has gone somewhere to eat turtle at the very time I wished to consult him about
the propriety of introducing a new niece to your lordship. Mary, Lord Cortland, Earl of Cortland, your uncle.
Uncle?
I hope you have recovered from the fatigue of your journey. It is very cold, is it not?
Cortland, it really is too bad to send the girl here when she's quite obvious.
Oh, you're my sister. Love me. Oh, love me.
Goodness. Well, do not agitate yourself so. Oh, you should learn to
overcome. Forgive me, my sister. This is very foolish to weep when I ought to rejoice, and I do rejoice. And I know I shall be so happy yet.
I shall have infinite pleasure in your society. But I have unluckily an engagement at this time. Come, Mary. You are not yet recovered from your journey. I shall take you to your room where you can rest. Tomorrow you will feel better.
Oh, for one kind word from my mother's lips. One kind glance from my sister's eye.
Oh. Good morning, Dr. Redgill.
Lady Emily, your servant. And this, I presume, is Miss Douglas. Your servant, Miss Douglas.
No, don't stir, Dr. Redgill. I know you have been upon hard service and would spare you any additional fatigue.
Fatigue? Oh, I'm sure I mind fatigue as little as any man. Besides, it's really nothing to speak of. I merely rode from my friend Admiral Yellowchops this morning. Oh,
no. I hope you passed a pleasant day there yesterday.
So-so, very so-so.
Well, so-so. And a turtle in the case?
Oh, after that, turtle was neither here nor there. I value turtle as little as any man. You would be sure it wasn't for that. I went to see my old friend Yellowchop. It happened, indeed, that there was a turtle, and a very well-dressed one, too, but when 35 people, and one half of them ladies, who, of course, were always helped first, sit down for dinner, and there's an end of all rational happiness, in my opinion.
But at a turtle feast, you have surely something much better. You know, you may have rational happiness any day over a beefsteak.
I beg your pardon. That's not such an easy matter. I can assure you, it is a work of no small skill to dress a beefsteak handsomely.
Well, I once saw an itinerant conjurer dress a beefsteak on his tongue.
Upon my honour. That was as clever a trick as ever I heard of. You are wonderful people, you Scots. Very wonderful people. But pray, were you at any pains to examine the fellow's tongue?
The love of science was not strong enough to make me run the risk of burning my fingers.
It is a thousand pities. I'm surprised none of your Scotch servants got hold of the fellow and squeezed the secret out of him. It might have proved an important discovery. Your Scotch are not apt to let anything escape them. They're as searching, shrewd people as ever I knew. And that's the only way to arrive at knowledge. A man must be of a stirring mind if he expects to do good. And now, you must excuse me. Poor woman has been waiting below this past hour to see me. These poor women are perfect pests to society. There's no resting upon one's seat for them. Always something the matter. They burn and bruise and hack themselves in their brats and not really think on purpose to give one trouble.
Who is that gentleman?
He is a sort of medical aide-de-camp of Papa's, who, for the sake of good living, has got himself thoroughly domesticated here.
It does not require much penetration to discover the doctor's master passion. Love of ease and self-indulgence seem to be the predominant features of his mind, and he looks as if he would not have an idea beyond, I wonder what we shall have for dinner today.
I'm glad to hear you say so, Miss Douglas. I rejoice to hear you say so. young ladies are much more husbandly in Scotland than they are in this country.
Angels, my feet!
angels.
At least they were when I knew Scotland.
Mother, my mother.
That's not yesterday.
Devil's kidneys, my angels, your favorite.
I studied physic in Edinburgh. Went upon a tour of the Highlands and Islands. Oh,
Dr. Redgill.
As much impressed by what I saw, I assure you. At your service, dear Lady Juliana.
I am anxious to consult you upon the state of this young person's health.
Mm-hmm.
You have been excessively ill, have you not, my dear?
Oh, not excessively, Mother.
Oh, you had a cough, I think. And as her friends in Scotland have sent her to me for a short time, entirely on account of her health, I think it quite proper that she should be confined to her own apartment during the winter.
Mother,
that she may get quite well and strong against spring. As to visiting or going in company, that, of course, must be quite out of the question.
Your ladyship confounds me. This young lady, I assure your ladyship, you need be under no apprehensions on her account. I own, my dear Miss Douglas, I was surprised to see you cut so good a figure after the delicious meals you have been accustomed to in the north. Our breakfasts are a disgrace to England. One would think the whole nation was upon a regimen of tea and toast. Scotch possess a prodigious advantage over us in that respect.
I thought the breakfasts, like everything else in Scotland, extremely disgusting.
You're a little nervous, that's all. Take her about, by all means. Show her the pump room and the shops. I never recommend confinement to man or woman.
Ah, Adelaide, what is the name of the physician at Bristol who is so celebrated for consumption complaints? I shall send for him. He is the only person I have any reliance upon. I know he always recommends confinement for consumption.
What would we be without appetites? Miserable beings, worse than the beasts of the field.
It appears to me, Mary, excessively extraordinary that Mrs. Douglas should have alarmed me so much about your health when it seems there's nothing the matter with you. She certainly showed little regard for my feelings. I can't understand it, and I must say, if you are not ill, I have been most excessively ill-used by your Scotch friends.
Oh, I've offended my mother, and I know not how. Tell me, how can I obtain her forgiveness?
I really don't know. Lady Juliana's always cross of a morning.
Obtain her forgiveness? For what?
Well, alas, I know not. But in some way I have displeased my mother. Her looks, her words, her manner all tell me how dissatisfied she is with me. Well, to my sister, and even to her very dogs.
If you expect to be treated like a dog, you will certainly be disappointed. I wonder Mrs. Douglas did not warn you of what you had to expect. She must have known something of Lady Juliana's ways. And it would have been as well had you been better prepared to encounter them.
Mrs. Douglas never spoke of my mother with disrespect. But she did warn me against expecting too much from her affection. She said I had been too long estranged from her to have retained my place in her heart. But still,
you could not foresee the reception you had met with. Nor I neither. Did you, Adelaide?
Lady Juliana sometimes the odds that I really am seldom surprised at anything she does. But all this fracas appears to me perfectly absurd, as nobody minds anything she says.
Impossible! My duty must ever be to reverence my mother. My study should be to please her. If I only knew how, and oh, would she but suffer me to love her? Oh,
gracious.
Oh, Mary, I don't know what to say to comfort you.
I know my comfort must come from a higher source, and I must seek it in solitude. This must be all for my own good, else it would not be. I had drawn too bright a picture of happiness. Already it is blotted out with my tears. I must set about replacing it with one of soberer colours.
Gracious.
Emily, at what time does the church service begin?
I really am not certain. I believe it is late. But why do you ask?
Because I wish to be there in proper time.
But we never go to the parish church. Not since Lady Juliana quarrelled with Dr. Barlow, the clergyman, over the propriety of dogs in the family pew. So you must say your prayers at home.
I would certainly prefer going to church.
Going to church? I wonder what makes people so keen on going to church. I'm sure there's little good to be got there. For my part, I declare I would just as soon think of going to my grave. Take my word for it, churches and churchyards are rather too nearly related.
In such a day as this, so dry and sunny, I am sure there can be no danger.
Well, take your own way, Miss Mary. But I think it my duty to let you know my opinion of churches. I look upon them as extremely prejudicial to the health. In fact, they are perfect receptacles of human infirmities.
What's that? Is Mary ill?
She will be if she persists in the folly of going to church.
I won't permit it. I don't approve of girls going about by themselves. It is vastly improper, and I won't hear of it.
But I have always been accustomed to attend church,
and that is sufficient reason for my choosing that you should not attend it here. I won't suffer a Methodist in the house.
I assure you the Methodists are gaining ground very fast. Upon my soul, I think it's very alarming.
What is so alarming?
Methodists, Lord Cortland. Zealots. Fanatics. Enthusiast bedlamites.
Dear Mother, I pray you let me go to church. The scripture saith, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together.
I desire I may hear no more about it. The clergyman is a most improper person. I won't suffer any of my family to attend his church.
Mother!
Oh, once and for all, I won't hear another syllable on the subject.
We have been commanded, honour thy father and thy mother. But Jesus Christ hath said, whosoever loveth father and mother more than me cannot be my disciple. I cannot obey your commands, Mother, when they are in opposition to the will of God. I pray that God will teach you to love him as I do. And if naught else availeth, then I pray that he who can stay the ocean's wave will be merciful and still the wilder tempests of your all too human passion. Forgive me, Mother, but I must go to church.
She is mad. I told you all, but you would not listen.
Lady Juliana, you must allow that Mary's upbringing has been quite different.
Different? Oh, indeed. She has been raised to be disobedient and ungrateful, and to thwart me at every turn. You see, Dr. Redgill, this is all your doing. You would not believe me when I told you she was ill. And now I find I am nursing a Methodist in my bosom.
A Methodist? A professed Methodist?
Mary does not look like a Methodist. She does not twirl her thumbs, nor speak through her nose, nor turn up her eyes.
Oh, her eyes were quite definitely turned up when she was insulting me. She is either a Methodist or inclined to fits.
On my honour, a young lady who can fly in her mother's face about such a trifle as going to church is not very safe company.
It was you, Dr. Redgill, said she should go about, and it has led to rebellion. I will have her shut up in a convent.
I think we should avoid religious controversy. Indeed.
Oh, indeed, Lord Cotton, no religious controversy.
In that case, I must find other ways and means to make sure she cannot infect the household. Particular care must be taken with the servants. The canaille are most susceptible to vulgar enthusiasms. And you, Adelaide and Emily, you must shun her, avoid all contact with her.
Good Lord, deliver us.
Yes, Lady Juliana.
If you had allowed me to shut her away, Dr. Redgill, I should not now have to shut her away.
To talk sense to a woman is like feeding chickens upon turtle soup.
Amen.
I am surprised my mother gave her permission for me to visit Mrs. Lennox. You know, she has not spoken to me or allowed me to leave the house since I went to church last Sunday.
Nasty old bird. Oh, you must realise, Mary, that Lady Juliana considers a visit to Mrs. Lennox as an act of penance rather than of pleasure. She is merely an unfortunate blind old lady whom everybody thinks is a bore to visit. Myself, I'm afraid, amongst that number.
How strange that Lady McLaughlin spoke of her so warmly as an old friend and insisted I deliver her letter in person.
Oh, Mrs. Lennox is a very good person, and I am very sorry for her and would visit her oftener if I thought it would do her any good. What can I possibly say to her after losing her husband and having I don't know how many sons killed in battle and her only daughter dying of a consumption and herself going blind in consequence of her grief for all these misfortunes? What can I possibly do for her or say to her? Hurrah! The lake is starting to freeze.
What a strange little bridge.
It is Chinese. Lord Cortland is replacing the classical follies with Chinese. See the Greek rotunda on the hill? Uh-huh. It is to have a new roof with bells at each corner.
What has happened to Mercury?
Oh, he will have his wings clipped and be set to fishing in the lake. But tell me, Mary, what would you do in Mrs. Lennox's case?
Well, I should hope.
What can she hope for now? She has still something to fear, however, as I believe she has one son remaining who is in the brunt of every battle. Of course, she has nothing to expect but accounts of his death.
But she may hope that heaven will preserve him, and that...
But you will marry him. That would do excellently well, for he is as brave as a real Highlander, though he has the misfortune to be only half a one. His father, General Lennox, was a true Scot to the very tip of his tongue and as proud and fiery as any chieftain need be. His death certainly was an improvement in the family.
Emily!
Look, down there is Rose Hall, with its pretty shrubberies and nice parterres. What do you say to becoming its mistress?
If I am to lay snares, it must be for nobler objects than hedgerow elms and hillocks green.
Oh, it must be for black crags and naked hills. Your country really does vastly well to rave about. But I suspect cornfields and barnyards are more comfortable neighbours. So take my advice and marry Charles Lennox.
Rose Hall is indeed perfectly English. It wears the appearance of antiquity without the usual accompaniments of devastation and decay. The ponds remain as round, the hedges as square, and the grass walks as straight as the day they were planned.
In short, it is as respectable and old-fashioned as Mrs. Lennox herself. Come, Mary. If I am to suffocate in beeswax and gloom, I shall enjoy my youth while I may. View, hello!
Mrs. Lennox?
Oh, come in, Lady Emily.
You must forgive our appearance. The weather is so fine, we walk from Beech Park rather than take the carriage.
A god has taken from me the necessity to concern myself with outward appearances.
Oh, of course. Forgive me. And I must beg your forgiveness also for the length of time since I last visited you. The days seem to fly past when you...
Do not blame yourself, my dear Lady Emily, for what is so natural at your age. And do not suppose I am so unreasonable as to expect that the young and the gay should seek pleasure in the company of an old, blind woman. At your time of life, I would not have courted distress any more than you.
At every time of life, I am sure you must have been a very different being from what I am, or ever shall be.
Ah, you little know what changes adversity makes in the character, and may you never know... Unless it be for your own good.
Ah, I doubt much if I shall ever be good on any terms. I don't think I have the elements of goodness in my composition. But here is my cousin, Mary Douglas, coming from Scotland. She is fit to stand proxy for all the virtues.
Mrs. Lennox, I have a letter from Lady McLaughlin. She...
Oh, my dear child, if I could but see your sweet face... Come, let me kiss it instead.
Here's a letter. Let me put it in your hand.
Oh, dear Mary. I know we shall be friends.
This is a picture of your son, Colonel Lennox, is it not? I mean the one that hangs below the lady in the satin gown with a bird in her hand.
Yes. And when I could look on that face, I forgot all I had lost. But I was too fond, too proud a mother. Give me your hand, Mary, dear. Ah, thank you.
Oh, forgive me, I didn't see the table.
Is the room dark? It is of no account. Now, look at it, my dear. He was only 18 when that was done, and many a hot sun has burned on the fair brow and many a fearful sight has met these sweet eyes since then. Sadly, that face may be changed, but I shall never see it more.
Indeed, it is a very dangerous face to look on, and I should be afraid to trust myself with it, were not my heart already pledged. As for my cousin, there is no fear of her falling sacrifice to hazel eyes and chestnut hair.
Emily!
Her imagination is all on the side of sandy locks and frosty grey eyes. I should doubt if Cupid himself would have any chance with her, unless he appeared in tartan plaid and Highland bonnet.
Then my Charles would have some, for he has lately been promoted to the command of a Highland regiment.
Indeed. That is very gratifying, and you have reason to be proud of Colonel Lennox. He has distinguished himself on every occasion.
Ah, the days of my pride are now past. 'Tis only the more honour, the greater danger, and I am weary of such bloody honours. See there! See these five lovely children. Three of these cherub heads were laid low in battle. The fourth, my Louisa, died of a broken heart from the loss of her brothers. Oh, what can human power or earthly honours do to cheer the mother who has wept o'er her children's graves? But there is a power that can sustain even a mother's heart. And here in this good book is the balm he has graciously vouchsafed to pour into the wounded spirit. My comfort is not that my boys died nobly, but that they died Christian. I beg your pardon, my dears, for talking in this serious manner to you who cannot be supposed to enter into sorrows to which you are strangers. But you must excuse me, though my heart does sometimes run over.
Oh, do not suppose that we are so heartless as to refuse to take part in the afflictions of others. Oh, surely none can be so selfish. Might I be allowed to come often, very often?
Ah. God hath indeed sent some into the world whose province it is to refresh the afflicted and lighten the eyes of the disconsolate. Such I am sure you would be to me. I feel my heart revive at the sound of your voice. It reminds me of my heart's darling, my Louisa. And the remembrance of her, though sad, is still sweet. Come to me then when you will, and God's blessing and the blessing of the blind and desolate will reward you.
Oh, goodbye, oh dear Mrs. Lennox. Oh, Emily. Oh, if only my own mother were... Oh, her poor, broken heart. Oh, I don't see, Emily. I don't see how you can sing quite so cheerfully.
Oh, I really require something of an exhilarating nature after Mrs. Lennox's dead march. It is an extraordinary kind of delight, Mary, that you take in being made miserable. For my part, it makes me quite wretched to witness suffering that I can't relieve. How can you or I possibly do Mrs. Lennox any good? We can't bring back her sons.
No, but we can bestow our sympathy, and that is always a consolation to the afflicted.
I don't quite understand the nature of that mysterious feeling called sympathy. When I go to visit Mrs. Lennox, she always sets me crying, and I try to set her a-laughing. Is that what you call sympathy?
No.
Then I suppose it is sympathy to blow one's nose and read the Bible. Is it that?
Oh, Emily, I cannot define
it. And I cannot comprehend it.
Oh, you will someday.
It's too bad, too bad. In another 10 minutes, the woodcock will be as cold as death. Soup's already ruined.
Is it true, Lady Juliana? Frederick, Lord Lindor, coming home?
Lord Courtland had a letter. We've been expecting him all afternoon. You here, Dr. Redgill. But when are you not?
I hope Lord Courtland has no thoughts of waiting dinner for Lord Lindor.
It is of no consequence when we sit down to dinner. Oh, Adelaide, my sweet. You look very sweet. Come, sit by me.
Thank you, Lady Juliana.
Lady Adelaide, I hope his lordship has no thoughts of waiting dinner for Lord Lindor.
Oh, I have no thoughts upon the subject.
Ooh. Mary, don't look so dejected when everybody else is so gay and happy.
I was thinking of Mrs. Lennox.
Oh, give your last sigh to the Lennox and your first smile to the Lindor.
His lordship would not wish us to wait dinner for Lord Lindor.
Oh, we ought undoubtedly to wait for Frederick.
Oh, Lady Juliana, what can have detained him?
Emily, I will have no vulgar consternation over punctuality.
I am thinking of your dogs, Lady Juliana. The poor brutes must be hungry.
Oh, there can be no danger to Orpheus and Eurydice, Dr. Redkin, if they are kept waiting.
Hydrophobia, the consequence of disappointment operating on an empty stomach. I have seen it often.
Oh, heavens! Well, in that case, we must eat immediately. Go at once, Dr. Redhill. Inform Lord Cortland.
Without delay, Lady Juliana.
Orpheus, Eurydice, come to me, my poor starvelings.
How does it happen, Emily, that you were in such ecstasies at the idea of seeing your brother have scarcely mentioned his name to me?
Why, to tell you the truth, I fear I was beginning to forget there was such a person. Oh. I have not seen him since I was 10 years old. At that time, he went to college and from thence to Italy. All I remember of him is that he was very handsome and very good-humoured, and all I have heard of him is that wherever he goes, he is the glass of fashion and the mould of form.
Oh, Cortland, Lindor will not come now. He will be dining with friends at Bath.
He is coming. He is coming.
I think it's as well we don't wait dinner for Lord Lindor.
Frederick! Frederick, we have been waiting and waiting for you.
Indeed, indeed.
Lord Lindor, how do you do?
We thought you would not come after all.
Lindor, what a beauty. What a delight. Italian greyhound, isn't it?
Lord Lindor, welcome, welcome. In another 10 minutes, the woodcock would have been ruined.
Dolci squardi, o parolette a corte.
Oh, he speaks Italian to his dog.
How do you do, Frederick? How do you do?
Well, Father, very well.
Dinner is waiting, Lord Cockburn.
Ah, yes. Yes, indeed.
Frederick, this is our cousin from Scotland, Miss Mary Douglas.
Miss Douglas?
Lord Lindor.
I really can't recommend either the turtle soup or the venison to your lordship today.
Adelaide.
Yes, Lord Lindor.
You are grown.
Yes, Lord Lindor.
If there's any roast beef or boiled mutton to be had, pray let me have it. Let Bacchante have the chicken.
Bacchante, how delightful. Oh, you have a new friend, Orpheus, Eurydice.
Roast beef or boiled mutton? Certainly, ma'am.
How did you contrive to arrive without being heard, Frederick? I was listening for your carriage.
I walked from Newbury House. I met Lord Newbury on my way here and stayed some days with him.
Vastly flattering to your friends here.
What? You walked all that way and the ground covered with snow? Frederick, how could you do such a foolish thing?
Simply because, as the children say, I liked it.
It's just of a piece with his liking boiled mutton, Miss Douglas. Yet to look at him, one would not expect such gross stupidity.
Well, Lady Juliana, Lindor has been with us almost 2 months. It is time you gave us our opinion of him. Lady Juliana?
What? Lindor? Where?
Oh, forgive me, Lady Juliana. I did not know you were asleep. I hope our playing billiards does not disturb you.
Asleep? Good heavens, no. I was reading the Times, I assure you. That was why you startled me.
Reading? Ah.
Yes, the Times. I cannot think or answer questions when I am reading.
But now you are not reading. So think of Lindor. Is your nephew not divine?
Perfectly so. I assure you, I think very highly of him. He is a vastly charming, clever young man, perfectly beautiful and excessively amiable. And his attention to dogs is quite delightful. It is so uncommon to see men at all kind to their dogs. I assure you, I have known many who were absolutely cruel to them, beat them and starved them and did 1,000 shocking things.
Pray, Adelaide, what is your opinion of my brother?
I have no doubt he is extremely amiable. As Mama says, his attentions to his dog prove it.
And you, Mary, are your remarks to be equally judicious and polite?
It is your shot, Mary, I believe.
I think him by much the handsomest and most elegant-looking man I have ever seen.
Yes, I know all that. But, however, no matter. I only wish he may have the sense to fall in love with you, Mary. How happy I should be to see you, Lady Lindor. Goodness, is it my shot already?
En attendant, you must take care of your heart, for I hear he is un peu volage and that he admires none but les dames mariées. As for Adelaide, there is no fear of her. She will never cast such a pearl away upon one who is merely extremely amiable.
Then you may feel equally secure upon my account, as I assure you I am in still less danger of losing mine after the warning you have given.
Warning? Frightening Miss Douglas with gothic tales? Oh, misera et horrible vision.
It was a warning that we are all heartily sick of one another. It is only the excitement of your arrival that has kept us alive these past weeks, Lindor, and now we expect you to entertain us.
You've certainly taken the most effectual method of sealing my lips.
How so?
By telling me that I'm expected to be vastly entertaining, since every word I utter can only serve to dispel the illusion and prove that I am gifted with no such miraculous power.
I don't think it requires any miraculous power, either to entertain or be entertained. For my part, I flatter myself I can entertain any man, woman, or child in the kingdom when I choose. And as for being entertained, that is still an easier matter. I seldom meet with anybody who is not entertaining, either from their folly, or their affectation, or their stupidity, or their vanity, or, in short, something of the ridiculous that renders them not merely supportable, but positively amusing.
How extremely happy you must be.
Happy? No. I don't know that my feelings precisely amount to happiness, neither. For at the very time I'm most diverted, I'm sometimes disgusted, too, and often provoked. My spirits get chafed, and then...
And you long to box the ears of all your acquaintances. Well, no matter. There is nothing so enviable as a facility of being amused. And even the excitement of anger is perhaps preferable to the stagnation of indifference.
Oh, thank heaven. I know nothing about indifference.
He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty.
Well, Mary, in that case, Adelaide is an angel, as she is slow to anger. And everything else.
Adelaide. Yes.
Come, Lindor, you positively must do something to signalize yourself. I assure you it is expected of you that you should be the soul of the company. Here is Adelaide, waltzes like an angel. When she can get a partner to her liking.
How unfortunate that I waltz like a mere mortal.
And that I am engaged to play whist with my uncle.
Oh, bel viso. Ove amor insieme pose gli sproni, el franon del mi punge e volve.
Waltzes? Yes, Lindor, you must have waltzes. We shall celebrate your homecoming with a ball.
Oh.
Next month, yes, I assure you, you shall have all the waltzes you wish.
It's on your head, says he. On your head.
Well, Mary, are you sorry to have abandoned psalm singing at Rose Hall for our rustic revels? I've hardly seen you these past weeks. You're so often there.
I feel of use at Rose Hall. My presence seems to lighten Mrs. Lennox's sufferings. And there have been so many visitors to Beech Park since Lord Lindo's arrival. I'm sure it was not missed.
Most degrading to see human creatures twirling one another about like so many monkeys.
Emily, where is Lindor. He was meant to open the ball with Lady Charlotte.
I found him reading Rousseau in his room. He seemed quite surprised to think his presence at all necessary. I left him dressing. There he is, making his entree with Lady Placid.
It's too bad of him.
I thought he had better sense. Dancing.
And with Lady Placid. It is too bad of him. Half the names here belong to the most insufferable people on earth, but nothing in human form is more insufferable than Lady Placid.
Does her merit lie only in her name, then?
In the opinion of all sensible persons, she is a vain, weak, conceited, vulgar egotist. In her own eyes, she is a clever, well-informed, elegant, amiable woman. Everything of hers must be superior to every other person's, and even what she is obliged to share in common with others acquires some miraculous charm in operating upon her. Thus, if she was to have the plague, she would assure you it was owing to some peculiar virtue in her blood.
Oh, Lady Placid, Madonna!
Oh, Lord Lindor, to say such things, were it not for the well-known severity of my morals, my husband would be jealous.
Lady Emily!
Oh, heavens, it is the Honourable Mrs. Downright and her son, poor William.
Lady Emily, you're quite hidden behind these potted palms. We almost didn't see you, and William is so anxious to ask you to dance.
He is ill to his uncle, Lord Glenallan, you know.
Come, William. Lady Emily is longing to dance.
Indeed, Mrs. Downright. Mr. Downright, nothing would give me more pleasure. Oh. Except Dr. Redhill has advised me against dancing this evening on account of my...
Ankle.
Ankle, yes. Both ankles, in fact, quite turned. Otherwise, I would...
And so, Lady Emily. Very sad, I'm sure. Come, William, I think Miss Glue has you fixed for the next dance.
Oh, I'm thankful she showed the cloven foot in time. Not the sort of girl one would wish for a wife.
Mary, I am amazed. You to say such a thing about my ankles.
Ankle? I said ankle, and only because of what you might say.
If I might presume to advise, Lady Emily. Oh, good evening, Mrs. Wiseacre. You quite startled me.
I could not help but overhear you tell Mrs. Downright about your ankle.
Ankle?
My opinion could be supposed to have any weight. I must just observe that you should have it in a raised position. Untold damage can be done to that type of injury if gravity is allowed to act upon it. I consider it my duty.
Oh, please, have my seat, Mrs. Wiseacre.
I rarely sit. The world will not let me sit. This chair is for Lady Emily's foot. Now, which angle is it, Lady Emily? Left or right?
Left.
There. All will be well if you keep your foot up. Up on this chair. I shall leave you now, knowing I have been of service. If poor Mrs. Drabble had but followed my advice, she would have been alive today. Depend upon it.
Such a pity, I thought. Such a pity.
Oh, dear. It is such a pity. There never was such a family so afflicted in their acquaintances as we are. Heavens, there is General Carver trying to catch my eye. Oh, he's coming over. Quick, we must fly.
Oh, can you walk?
He is the bore of bores. I shall defy gravity to do its worst.
A little claret and a few nuts.
It's not every mother that will make the sacrifices for their family, I don't know.
It certainly is no affair of mine, but at the same time...
Adelaide, occhiami biondi. De che il cor manoda amore.
Lady Placid's hair is blonde, Lord Lindor. Almost white, one might say.
On your head, says he.
Dr. Redhill is waving at us.
Where?
At the door of the supper room.
He appears to be waving a chicken leg.
And a piece of paper.
No doubt the recipe for a breaded chicken
Miss
leg.
Douglas! Miss Douglas! Miss Douglas! Miss Douglas, I've been searching for you everywhere. Hardly a moment to eat supper. Here's a message come for you.
For me? Oh, what can it be? Oh, it is from Mrs. Lennox, housekeeper. Oh, dear. Oh, well, I must go at once.
Not without your supper, Miss Douglas.
What's wrong?
I advise you to take a little supper.
Mrs. Lennox is ill. She has had a letter which greatly disturbs her. The housekeeper does not survive, but she is calling for me. She needs me. Oh, well, I must go.
Mary!
Oh, Emily, forgive me, but I must go.
I shall ring for the carriage.
Yes, yes, at once, but I must go.
Mary? My child, is it you?
Yes, Mrs. Lennox, I'm here. Oh, what is wrong? What's happened?
My son, my child, oh. He is coming. I shall see him tonight. See him. Oh, God, help me. I shall never see him more.
But you will hear him. You will hold him to your heart. You will be conscious that he is beside you.
Yes, thank God. I shall once more hear the voice of a living child. Oh, how often do those voices ring in my heart that are all hushed in the grave. I am used to it now, but to think of him returning to this wilderness. When he last left it, he had father, brother, sisters, and to find all gone.
But he has you yet, now even more precious to him.
Alas, he cannot joy in seeing me such as I am. I have too long concealed from him my dreary doom. He knows not that these poor eyes are sealed in darkness. How will he bear to behold the mother he so loved and honoured, now blind, bereft and helpless?
But he will find you resigned, and after the pain of realisation will come the joy of love restored.
Oh, Mary, God bless you, my dear. He only can repay you for the good you do me. You will not leave me.
No, no, I will be here by your side while you have need of me. Shall I read to you?
Yes, my dear. If you are not too tired, fetch your little stool and sit here by me. And in my writing box you will find some papers tied with black ribbon.
Yes.
Thank you. Ah, here my Louisa speaks to me even from the tomb. These are the words she wrote to me but a few hours before her death. Read them for me. for it is not every voice I can bear to hear uttering her last thoughts.
Forever gone, oh chilling sound, that tolls the knell of hope and joy, but end with torturing pang to wound, but not in mercy to destroy. Forever gone, what words of grief, replete with wild mysterious woe, the Christian kneels to seek relief. A saviour died. It is not so. Forever
my
gone.
Children.
Oh, madness wild.
Yes,
dwells
I
in that
drear
and atheist doom.
Was in heaven.
But death of horror is despoiled when heaven shines forth beyond the tomb. Forever gone.
Oh
dire
none
despair.
But a mother can tell
look
the bitterness
to the heavens.
Of these tears which
the
fall
earth,
from a mother's
sea.
Eyes.
Go. Read a saviour's promise there. Go. Heir of immortality.
And yet. Methinks I would rather have suffered all than have stood in the world a lonely being.
It is he!
My mother!
My son! My son!
My mother. Let me look once more upon your dear face. Dear mother, do I indeed find you thus? Oh!
In episode 2 of Marriage, Mary was played by Meg Fraser, Emily by Fiona Francis, and Charles by Dougal Lee. Juliana was played by Vivian Dixon, Adelaide by Harley Loudon, Aunt Jackie and Mrs. Lennox by Anne Scott-Jones, Aunt Grizzy by Rose McBain, Aunt Nikki by Eliza Langland, Dr. Redgill by Crawford Logan, Archie Douglas by Simon Tate, Lord Lindor by Gregor Powery, and Mrs. Douglas by Ali Walton. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Marriage was dramatised by Patricia Hannah from the novel by Susan Ferrier and directed in our Edinburgh studios by Patrick Rayner.